This is Vermont Edition. I'm Jane Lindholm. These days, if you want to look at those wonderful constellations Mark Breen tells us about in Eye on the Night Sky, or see the detail of the surface of the moon on a clear night, you can buy a relatively inexpensive telescope and set it up in your backyard. But that's a pretty modern invention, the affordable home telescope. For stargazers 100 years ago, you either had to be rich to get a telescope or be willing to make your own. That's what Russell Porter did. Born and raised in Springfield, Vermont, he was a machine shop owner and an Arctic explorer. He wanted to make it more possible for ordinary people to own telescopes, so he started the Springfield Telescope Makers Club. Each year, the club got together and shared ideas and knowledge on building their own telescopes. Nearly 100 years later, the club is still going, and their annual Stellafane convention starts today. Joining me now to explain why you should be interested in making your own telescope rather than just slapping down the plastic and buying one is Tom Spirock. He's a longtime member and a former secretary of the Springfield Telescope Makers. Tom, what a pleasure to have you on the program.
Thanks for inviting me.
So tell me more about this Russell Porter fellow. He sounds like a pretty interesting guy.
Yes, Russell Porter was pretty much a genius about art, anything art or engineering. He could design anything mechanical. He was a painter. He was a sketcher. And he was basically a big idea man.
So he had this idea that people should be able to see the sky, and they were going to have to make their own telescopes to do it because it just was not affordable to be buying your own telescope if you were a regular person 100 years ago. So did he, given that he was already, a machine shop owner, did he have the skills already or did he have to learn them on his own?
Well, his mechanical skills came in very handy. However, he was very smart and he got his hands on some mirror blanks and he learned how to grind his own mirror and then he had to build a mechanical part of the telescope to support them. And so he basically taught himself and then he got together a group of other machine shop people in Springfield. And he taught them how to make their own telescopes, and that's how they formed the group.
Were people actually at the time interested in seeing the sky? Was there a real desire to be able to see what's happening in the night sky?
Probably similar today, and although they had the advantage of a lot less light pollution, so they could see the stars more easily, but perhaps it was one of those things they might not have thought of, because if you look at Russell Porter's writings, he talks about how wonderful it is not only just to look at the stars, but to look at the stars and understand them from something you made yourself. That's what he thought was important.
Do you know how much it actually did cost to buy a telescope at the time? We're talking about the 1920s here.
Well, there really wasn't such a thing as, quote, buying a telescope. Mm. You had to have it essentially made custom. So there wasn't, even if you were rich, there wasn't a store you can go to and buy an expensive telescope. You had to basically have it designed from scratch.
There was no Amazon, not.com at the time for telescope enthusiasts.
Right. Yeah, even if you were rich, yes.
So what about making a telescope, though? That can't have been cheap either.
Well, it all depends on how you do it. And actually, part of the whole point of the Stellafane Convention is to learn how to do things, inexpensively. You make a telescope out of the parts you have on hand. One of the things we have is a swap meet where people will sell their old or used parts, pieces of metal, pieces of wood or such, that you might not think of it can go on a telescope just by looking about it by itself. But if you're into the hobby, understand how to make a telescope, you can basically incorporate almost anything.
We're talking today about telescope making. We're going to be talking about astronomy, amateur astronomy. And listeners, we would love to hear from you. Have you ever actually been to the Stellafane Convention? It's in Springfield every year. It starts tonight, this year. A lot of you have probably been to it or heard about it. We'd love to hear your experiences. Why do you think it's valuable not only to see the night sky and understand what's happening up in the outer reaches of our universe, but also perhaps to make your own telescope? Does that interest you? Well, we have Tom Spirock with us today. So if you have a question for him or if you would just like to share your story, you can call 1-800-639-2211. That's 1-800-639-2211 or post your thoughts on the Vermont Edition page at vpr.net. Tom, do you have a sense of how many people who are connected with the Springfield Telescope Makers have actually made telescopes over the years?
Well, in order to be a member of the telescope makers, you actually have to grind and polish and figure your own mirror. So we have two classes of membership, associate and full. The associate members are the new people or the beginners, and the more senior members guide them how to make their own mirror. So all of the full members, by definition, have had to make your own mirror.
And any sense of the numbers, how many people that might be?
The total membership is on the order of 110 or 120, and it's probably maybe half or two-thirds are full members.
Wow. So that's right now you've got 120 or so people.
That's correct.
Wow.
And so, that's different from the actual conventioneers.
Okay. So why don't you tell us about that? Because you have these members, and as you said, these are all people who are telescope makers. I mean, it's right in the name of the club. But conventioneers can come to the Stellafane Convention each year and don't have to feel bad if they are not actually telescope makers themselves.
Well, certainly not. Actually, the whole point of the convention is to get them interested and teach them. A big part of the convention is we have classes, we have demonstrations, we have lectures. People can actually, they can't necessarily grind their own mirror, but we have samples where they can, we call it getting your hands dirty with the grit, and they actually do it themselves. So the whole point is we want inexperienced but interested people to attend so we can teach them.
But these people who are members of the club now, as you said, everyone has made a telescope. How much time does it typically take people?
Well, there is no such thing as typical. It all depends on your experience and how much time you put into it. If you're very experienced and you're making, say, a 6 or 8 inch telescope, you can, and you work on it a lot, you can do it in a few days. But if you're just learning, it could take some months.
How long does it take you? Let's talk about your telescopes.
Well, my original one, because it was my first, took me quite a while. And then when I got involved with the club more, the club actually has club resources and club telescopes. So I helped out a lot building the club telescopes, not necessarily my own personal one.
How many telescopes have you made over the years?
One of my personal, and then I've helped with the club telescopes.
What got you excited about making telescopes in the first place?
Personally, I really don't necessarily know. I just can remember as a kid always been interested in astronomy, and I guess I liked to build things. And then when I found out about some local friends from a local astronomy club who came up here every year, I came along with them once, and it seemed just like an interesting thing to do.
And you haven't stopped since, I take it?
That's correct. I've been coming. Actually, this will be my 30th convention in a row. But I know another fella who's been coming up for 50 years in a row.
Wow. Tom, do you mind telling me about some of the characters who are in the club? I mean, I know that I don't mean reveal secrets about people, but there must be people like you and like this fellow that you just mentioned who's been coming for 50 years who are really passionate about this, because this does strike me as a club that's all about passion and interest and excitement about learning a skill, a very detailed skill, and then helping teach it to others. So tell me about some of the characters.
Well, there's a very large spectrum of, I guess, professions. We have engineers, we have doctors, nurses, computer programmers, machinists, pretty much anything you can think of. But like you said, the key word is they have the passion for the sky, the passion to look at the stars, the passion to make the telescope. And it's really all about, even though the telescopes themselves are the mechanism that draws us together, it's really about meeting your friends and kind of everybody's your friend just because they show up. I've spent time talking to people in the middle of the night. I've never seen them, and I might never see them again, but you can spend 2 hours talking to them like they're your old friend.
Does it help that it's dark?
Not necessarily in the social way, but we also, of course, while we like to make the telescopes, we like to use them too. So the fact that it's dark enables us to see the stars.
We got a note from Charles Fulco, who posted on our webpage and said, I'm actually heading up to Stellafane for the first time, and I'll be giving the keynote address at Harkness House on Thursday evening. I'll be talking about how I have left my longtime classroom teaching position in New York in order to generate nationwide educational and public outreach for the upcoming 2017 total solar eclipse. Charles says, I hope to glean some tips and make some good contacts at Stellafane to further my efforts. I'm going to prove that old school telescope makers and modern technology can make a difference in science education. Tom, do you find that all of this new technology is dampening the interest people have in making their own telescopes?
Perhaps it does somewhat because, like you said, previously, 100 years ago, if you wanted a telescope, you had to make it. Where nowadays, for not an unreasonable amount of money, you can buy a very good telescope. So people really tend to build telescopes only if they want to. If they just want to look at the stars, and I don't mean just in a bad way, but if that's their primary interest, they tend to buy their own telescope. So it's we're somewhat of a minority of a minority. So there's much less of us perhaps than there used to be.
So do you feel like everybody who's in the club has to be in some ways an evangelist and really trying to get out there and getting people excited about this?
Well, perhaps they don't have to be, but for some reason, all people or most people who are involved in amateur astronomy consider it a duty to educate the public. There's what's called star parties, and probably every amateur astronomy club in the country will hold periodic gatherings where their members will get their telescopes, whether they're homemade or not, and set them up and invite the public to look. So it's for some reason, it seems for the most part to be ingrained in amateur astronomers to want to educate the public.
Well, we would love to do more about educating the public. Tom Spurok has, as we've discussed and found out, made his own telescope. I have not, but I find this fascinating. And listeners, if you want to talk to Tom about what he's seen in the night sky or why this is such a passion for him that he's been back to this convention in Springfield 30 years in a row, you can give us a call. Our number is 1-800-639-2211. That's 1-800-639-2211. Tell us what you want to know about what it actually takes to make your own telescope, the materials, how much mathematics you need to know. You can also post your thoughts on the Vermont Edition page at vpr.net. I'm Jane Lindholm, and this is Vermont Edition. Tom Spurok, a longtime member and former secretary of the Springfield Telescope Makers, is with us today talking about the joy he gets out of the club's annual Stellafane Convention and offering tips and tidbits on how you can make your own telescope to reveal the secrets of the night sky. Listeners, if you have a question for him, call 1-800-639-2211. That's 1-800-639-2211, or you can post on the Vermont Edition Facebook page. In a couple of minutes, we're going to talk a little bit more about what happens at the Stellafane Convention. It starts tonight and runs through Sunday, and there's actually a telescope-making competition, and I'd love to hear more about that. But before we get into it, let's go to Heidi, who's calling us from Montpelier. Hi, Heidi. Go ahead.
This is Heidi.
Oh, hi, Heidi. Yes, go ahead.
I would like to ask tell Tom that I knew Charlie Thayer, who was one of the my husband and I knew him, and he was passionate many years ago about Stellafane. He was one of the early people who started that started working there as a volunteer.
Yes, I knew Charlie very well until he passed away. He actually lived just a quarter mile away or so, and for 50 years or more, he was there most every day, working on the land, getting ready for the convention. He ran the AV system. He trained a lot of us in how to be a Springfield telescope maker in those days.
So sounds like a pretty essential guy to the club.
Well, at the time, before the 80s, there were much less members, and but there was still a lot of work to do, and Charlie basically did whatever he needed to do.
We got a note from Rick who says, in the 15 years since I moved to Vermont, I have discovered that it seems to be one of the cloudiest places on Earth. The sky is perpetually gray compared to my home state, and Rick wants to know from you, Tom, how do you manage to do astronomy in such difficult conditions? Now, I know you live right on Long Island, but you know, same region we're talking about here, and certainly even for people trying to see the Perseids this week, we've encountered some pretty rotten conditions in some places.
Well, that's true. The Northeast and the East is not good for astronomy. There's a reason that there are no professional observatories within 2,000 miles of here. It's just the way it is. This is where Russell Porter started the club, so this is where we are.
But for you, does that dampen your enthusiasm, or does it actually make it more exciting that you have to wait, you know, and hope for the right weather and hope you can catch these things at the right time with the clear skies?
I won't say it dampens our enthusiasm. It's just something you have to deal with, and you make the best of it.
Larry's on the line with us from Rutland. Hi, Larry. Your turn. Go right ahead.
Hi. I've got a background in surveying for the last 40-plus years, and when I first started in 73 back in Oregon, I was using instruments then that were probably 40 or 50 years old, and so I just wondered if, you know, any of the stargazers had adapted these to, you know, stargazing. They're good instruments, not that powerful. I mean, maybe around 30 power for a Wild or a Kern or Hilger Watts, but I remember being able to see the moons of Jupiter and things like that faintly. So I just wondered, you know, those are out there. I just wondered if they've ever been used.
Larry, thanks for the call. Tom?
Well, if I'm not mistaken, in general, surveying instruments have a relatively small aperture to collect the light, which is fine for what they're doing. And sure, that they could see the moon and some bright objects. But in general, with a telescope, stars and various objects we look at tend to be on the dim side. The moon is very unusual in how bright it is. So we want either a lens or a mirror to catch the light that's much bigger, 6, 8, 10, or, you know, as big as you can get.
Can you actually take me through the steps, Tom? Because what I have trouble picturing as somebody who's never made a telescope and has limited experience even looking through them, how do you make one? What are the steps? Let's start right at the beginning.
Well, assuming you choose to make your own mirror, which is the heart of the whole telescope, people tend to think it's much harder than it actually is. The simplest way is you buy what are called blanks. Say you want to make a 6-inch telescope, you buy two discs of glass. They're 6 inches in diameter, about an inch thick, and you buy what's called carborundum grit. It's essentially just ground up like dirt particles, and you put the dirt particles on there, and you put some water, and you start grinding these mirrors together back and forth and back and forth. And that process, one of the discs will wear out faster in the center, and the other will wear out faster in the edges. And you just keep doing that over and over after a million times, and you get the curve of your telescope. That's, you know, in two sentences, that's basically it. And then you have to improve that curve by what we call fine grinding, which means we get rid of all the scratches, and then we polish it with some polishing compound and a pitch lap, which we make it perfectly clear. And then what's very important with a telescope is it has the right figure or curve. And this is where you hear telescopes where we have to work to on the order of a millionth of an inch. And we can do that, and it's actually not nearly as hard as people think. The tester that we used, I like to tell people the primary components to this tester, where we can measure telescope mirrors to a millionth of an inch, consist of three razor blades and a light bulb. And we have, which is literally true, and we have directions on how to do all this, including build this tester, on our website.
So you're telling me that somebody can test the curve of their lens using three razor blades and a light bulb?
Held up with the appropriate pieces of wood and making some very simple measurements and calculations, yes.
And then if you're off, what do? You just keep grinding?
Well, the part where we do the measurements is called figuring, when we're making our mirror just right. And, yeah, you have to understand and learn that if you have problem A, you change your stroke this way a little bit, and if you have problem B, you do this. What it's best to do is to pick a mentor and stick with one person and let them teach you. And then they'll tell you and show you and get you experiences in all these various subtleties.
So you've talked a little bit about the two mirrors, the two pieces of glass that you use, the lenses. But what then do you encase them in, and how important is that to your functioning telescope?
Well, it's very important, because you can have the best mirror in the world, but if it shakes so bad you can't see it, it's not really worth anything. So you have to decide what kind of mount you want, and you have various choices. You can make an equatorial, you can make a Dobsonian, et cetera, et cetera. And it all depends on what your skills are. Do you want to work in wood? Do you want to work in metal? How much time you want to spend? How much money you want to spend? What your skills are? So there's a very large variety of choices.
So you mentioned you were giving an example of if you were making a 6-inch telescope. So how big are the telescopes that people come to Stellafane with to show off that they've made?
Well, you can have some small refractors that are 2 or 3 inches, and the biggest typical telescope that arrives at convention, actually someone from Long Island who made a 32-inch telescope. So the mirror is 32 inches across, and the tube is about 10 feet long. You literally need a ladder to climb up the ladder and to be able to look through it.
And in terms of what you can see from a mirror that's 32 inches across versus one that's 6 inches across, how big a difference does that make?
It's a tremendous difference. Every time you double the aperture or the size of the mirror, you collect 4 times the light. So as you go from 6 to 12 to 24, et cetera, the light gathering ability is tremendous. So however, you have to keep in mind there are trade-offs. It's much easier to transport a small 3 or 4 inch telescope than it is a 32. This particular person needs a van, and he has kind of a truck rigged up just to move it. Whereas if you have a 3 or 4 inch telescope, it's very easy to put in your car. So there are a lot of trade-offs to keep in mind.
I imagine it's also so nerve-wracking. I mean, it's one thing when you have the chance of ruining something that you spent a lot of money on, and certainly nobody likes to do that. But when you've put your own blood, sweat, and tears into something, and then you have to transport this telescope, every pothole must make you cringe.
Actually, telescopes tend to be pretty robust once they're made. And once you get the figure made and the mirror made and you get it mounted in the telescope, it's pretty unusual to have problems. They may be out of alignment a little bit when you, like you said, hit a pothole. But with a few turns of a screw, you get it back together. So once the mirror is made and in the telescope, it's pretty safe.
What a relief. We're talking with Tom Spirock. He's a longtime member and former secretary of the Springfield Telescope Makers. If you're in southern Vermont or anywhere in our region, you may have heard of Stellafane. That's the name of the annual convention that the Springfield Telescope Makers have. It's also the nickname of the clubhouse and the place where this convention is held. This year is the 80th convention. They started in the 1920s but took a break during World War II. And some of you may be going. Some of you may have just an interest in astronomy and like to weigh in here. What intrigues you about looking at the night sky and learning about what's out there? And do you ever think about what it would take to make your own telescope? Do you have any interest in that when you can buy one pretty cheaply now for yourself? What would encourage you to actually make your own telescope? You can send us a note. Just post it on the Vermont Edition page at vpr.net or call 1-800-639-2211. That's 1-800-639-2211. We got a note from Scott who says, "All I have to do to get my Richmond neighbors out on the street is to set up my 6-inch diameter telescope. The best part is to watch the gasp of every person who looks through the eyepiece." And then we got a note from Smokey Chick who says, "I used to live in Springfield, and I remember that Stellafane was very concerned about the light pollution potential from the prison. Has the light been a problem?" She says, "I moved before the dust settled." What about that, Tom?
Well, those of us who look at the sky are always concerned with light pollution. And yes, there was some specific concerns about the prison. However, there was some mitigation issues that were offered. So essentially, any light that was put in by the prison was paid for to reduce light in the near vicinity. So it's basically considered to be pretty much a wash from the prison specifically.
What about for where you go to watch the stars normally and to look through your telescope? Is it a problem for you?
Actually, I spend most of my time looking at the sky up at Stellafane.
Aha. And so you find that this must be a pretty good place. I mean, given that it has limited light pollution, but also, as we heard from one of our listeners earlier, a problem with cloudy skies sometimes. What's the outlook for this weekend? Have you checked the weather report?
From what I understand, at least the big rain should be over. So we're kind of hopeful this weekend.
What are you most looking forward to at the convention this weekend?
Well, probably the biggest difference this year was we're going to have the our keynote speaker will be Alan Stern, who's the primary investigator for the craft that just flew by Pluto a month ago. And he's going to be talking about all the new discoveries they just made.
Tell us a little bit more about what you think he's going to talk about and what he's found.
Well, part of the interesting thing is we don't know. That's kind of the whole point of sending these probes. I kind of have purposely not been paying attention to the little dribs and drabs because I want to see his real fancy new color pictures he's got.
Tom, can you tell us a little bit about what intrigues me, which is the competition for telescope makers? how varied it is, how fierce the competition is? Does it feel friendly or competitive?
For the most part, it's very friendly. We have a term that when someone comes up with a new idea and they display it, that it's perfectly okay to steal their idea and use it on your own. That's kind of why they're doing it, to teach each other. So in general, it's very friendly, but we try to take it serious too.
Well, so what happens? How is it judged?
Well, we have two primary categories. One is optical competition and one is mechanical. The optical takes place at night and is for people who've made their own mirror or lens. And the judges will take the telescope, point it at a bright star, and by looking at the out-of-focus images, they can tell the quality of the optics. And it's kind of a tough job because I got to do it at 3 in the morning and try to remember these various out-of-focus images from several telescopes and then debate on who's the best. But they do a very good job at it. And then there's the mechanical, where we judge the engineering, how nice it looks, craftsmanship, if they have any new mechanical ideas. And we literally will grab the telescope and move it around and knock on it to see if it shakes and run the focuser and see how smooth it is. So it's a very hands-on event.
And are you one of the judges in the mechanical part?
I'm a mechanical judge, yes.
Huh. So when you said it's okay to steal ideas from anybody whose telescope you really like, have you found when you're judging the mechanical side of things that you've seen things that you thought, ooh, I'd like to do that?
That's the best part of mechanical judging, is because we tend to be so busy during the convention that you can't always get to see everything, and especially you might not get to see the telescopes that are displayed for competition. So being a good judge, it guarantees me to see that.
Let's go to Edward, who's calling in from Montreal. Hi, Edward. You're on the air.
Hi. Recently, there have been a bunch of probes that have visited objects in our solar system. There was the New Horizons at Pluto, and there was the Rosetta and Philae probes at that comet. And when I see those images, those places, what were once sky objects, they become like physical places. Like you can see the gravel and the rocks, and it looks just like gravel and rocks on the Earth. And the effect that it's had on me is actually those go from being like mysterious shiny objects in the sky to actual physical places, and that's been a real shift for me in the past year.
Edward, that's very cool. Does what Tom's talking about with making your own telescope intrigue you at all? I mean, you're not certainly going to see those same photos that you've been seeing from the probes and from those missions, but does it excite you enough to think, I might actually get into this?
Yeah, I'm a pretty geeky guy, and I think I'd like to hang out with other geeky people.
Well, there are many people from Canada and Montreal come down to convention, and they bring some pretty good telescopes with them.
All right, Edward, so you can find somebody to carpool with or just go next year. Tom, before we let you go, what's the most amazing or interesting thing that you've seen through your telescope?
Well, mine is probably going to be similar to most people, and that's Saturn. For some reason, when you see Saturn, especially through a good telescope, and actually the club telescope that I mentioned I helped make is it's a special kind of telescope that's specifically designed to give us good views of the planets. It's probably one of the best in the world. To see Saturn through a high-quality telescope on a clear sky is just about the best you're going to get.
That's Tom Spirok. He's a longtime member and former secretary of the Springfield Telescope Makers. Their annual Stellafane Convention runs today through Sunday. Tom, thank you so much for being on the program, and here's hoping for clear skies all weekend.
Thank you very much.
Coming up, you can't put a price on good art or even mediocre art if it's a relic that preserves both Burlington's history and the legacy of the early Jewish community in the region. We'll explain coming up next on Vermont Edition. Welcome back to Vermont Edition. I'm Jane Lindholm. One of the last wooden synagogue murals in the country, possibly the last of its type in the world, spent the last 20 years behind a plaster wall in a rug store come apartment building. It was painted right onto the inside of a curved roof by Lithuanian immigrant Ben Zion Black for a Burlington temple in 1910. And it's been a labor of love and a feat of engineering and fundraising to get what has become known as the Lost Shul mural to its new home at the Ojavi Zedek Synagogue in Burlington. It was unveiled to the public last week. The three panels of the mural hang high above in an open space, stretching 24 feet long and 11 feet high. I visited Ojavi Zedek last week with the synagogue's president, Jeffrey Potash, and archivist Aaron Goldberg, to learn more about the mural's history and meaning. Jeff, maybe you can describe what it actually looks like, this mural.
Looking up about 11 feet at this miraculous piece of work, the rich royal blue underscores that we are essentially contained within the Ark of the Covenant.
What's amazing about these colors is that they match the colors that are described in the Book of Numbers. Blue is a sacred color that was used at the time when the high priest entered the tent of the tabernacle and then entered the temple. You're looking at it from the perspective of the men and all of the Orthodox synagogues, there were three in Burlington at that time. The men would have been on the first floor looking up at about this 45-degree angle, and the women would have been located in the second floor women's prayer gallery looking straight at it from about 50 feet back. And he actually had painted an entire blue sky, which was heaven, that was filled with clouds and musical instruments, and that went over the women's gallery. And unfortunately, that does not survive, nor does the first floor, although we do have a picture of the first floor image from 1910.
So, Jeff, can you tell me a little bit more about this artist, Ben Zion Black, and what he was doing in Vermont, how he got here, and why he was painting this mural in 1910?
Well, the 1910 painting piece is rather interesting. So the Jewish community begins in Burlington in 1885. They come to Burlington initially as peddlers. They settle because Burlington is a thriving metropolis, and they clearly want a better life in the old North End. They build a synagogue in 1885, and this is a classic Jewish joke dictates, within 4 years, they have a second synagogue for a population we estimate to be probably about 200 or 300 people. In 1910, the community is thriving. We estimate upwards of 1,200 to 1,300 people now have come, largely from Lithuania, in the presence of greater amounts of wealth and prosperity. You know, they want to embellish. The circumstances surrounding why Ben Zion Black has to do with the fact that the man, as Aaron has alluded to, he was an accomplished impresario. He was putting on Yiddish plays in addition to being a fairly effective painter in Lithuania. He actually traveled around various locations in Europe, painted a variety of pieces, and managed to make his way to Burlington in the latter part of 1909. So it just was serendipitous that he was here, you know, on the occasion when they were looking to embellish their synagogue, and that's how it came to be.
It's been noted that this mural now here at Ojavi Zedek looks like it belongs here and like it should have been here forever, but of course it was not painted here in 1910, as we've established. And Aaron, I understand you spent the last 30 years trying to make sure that this was preserved and displayed somewhere where people can really admire and observe it and understand its historical context. So how much of an effort was it over the past 30 years to finally get it here?
Well, to begin with, I've dreamed about it for decades. The active work on it has been in really two stages. I saw the mural in high school. That building was then used as a carpet store. And I remember going to Haribo Carpet Master on Hyde Street with my mother and buying carpet. And you could then see the second floor of the mural. Scroll forward to 1986. The building that housed the Chai Adam Synagogue is sold into private hands. And another former congregant of ours alerts us to this fact, and we approach the building owner. The woman's name was Barbara Francis, and she was very cooperative and agreed to wall up the mural with a false wall of plaster. So there were then tenants in that building from 1986 through 2012, when we start in earnest again on the mural project. And so we opened it in 2010 for a day, and Jeff and I have been, I think, working more than full-time on this project since 2012.
Jeff, is this a great work of art?
This is a survivor of an era. No, it's not great work. But what it is it's inspired work. All walks of life and circumstance are truly taken with it. It does speak. It has voice. Certainly in terms of Vermont history, when one thinks of the heyday of the immigrant arrivals, typically between the 1860s and the early part of the 20th century, in Burlington there are just waves of immigrants who pour in. Each pretty much follows the same stead, which is within a generation they assimilate into the larger whole, and within two or three generations they've forgotten their past. It's rather intriguing to us that the children, the grandchildren, of Ben Zion Black, who knew their grandfather well, never knew he painted this.
And beyond that, it's also been identified by many as really a cultural treasure for all immigrant groups. As our former Governor Cunin has expressed, it is literally a symbol of freedom over oppression and hope over despair. So when we walled it up, we didn't know that we'd ever get it out from behind the wall. And now we have literally brought it out into the light.
It doesn't seem like it would be overstating things in this case, then, to say that in some ways this mural really is priceless. Priceless to the Jewish community in Vermont, priceless to the Vermont community to look at its own history. So I say this not to put a price tag on it, but the irony is not lost on me that I think Ben Zion Black was paid, what, $200 to paint this mural?
It took him 6 months.
6 months and $200, and the restoration, which is not complete yet, has cost upwards of $500,000.
Yes.
But, Jeff, it's worth it.
Absolutely. And, I can't help but believe that he would have absolutely been hysterical about this. I mean, the number of ironic components, I mean, as Aaron described, I mean, this resided within the building that wouldn't have had anything to do with this particular congregation. They would have been separate. So, you know, to the degree that we brought the two congregations together, after 80-some-odd years, you know, truly is a testimonial as well, to the fact that that things are always changing.
We have characterized it this way before. It is a portal. When you look at the mural, you are transported backwards in time.
It must be fun for the two of you to, as Jeff mentioned, see people walk in, especially if they're not expecting it, and look at it. But for both of you, you've seen this so many times now, and you've thought about it so many times, and you've been so deeply involved in it. Do you ever catch yourself now walking through and being surprised or finding something new or seeing it afresh? I mean, what do you think about when you look at this? Aaron?
It's very surreal still, having known what this lobby looked like without it. For us to see it here is just miraculous for me personally. And you can see that we have literally, in order to save the mural, we have taken an entire roof structure with it, because the mural itself is only about a half an inch thick, painted on wood lath.
Why it weighs something like 6,500 pounds?
Yes. And so it's encapsulated within the wooden roof frame and within steel, because we had to figure out a way to only move it once, and that meant framing it in the other building, but also figuring out how it would be fitted here. So there are steel beams that had to be installed in the ceiling in order to hang it and with suspension rods so it looks free-floating, which was always the intention. So, yes, I'm pinching myself every time I walk in. I can't believe that it's here and that that the community has risen to the challenge of saving it.
And Jeff, for you?
What intrigues me, Jane, as you mentioned, I mean, he earned $200 and an incredible amount of criticism. The man basically encased us in the Ark of the Covenant. It's a statement about, on the one hand, a culture that believed in egalitarianism. It was developed at a time when for these people, this was a new opportunity. Ahavi Zedek, lovers of justice, Chayotim, lovers of man. I mean, these people were starting anew, and they created this wondrous world. And this takes us back into that and reminds us, of how important that spirit of egalitarianism, that spirit of welcome is. So my hope is that it will continue to speak to people for generations to come.
That was Jeff Potash, president of the Ojavi Zedek Synagogue, and Aaron Goldberg, the synagogue's archivist, talking about Ben Zion Black's shul mural. We are going to be putting photos up so you can see what this amazing piece of art actually looks like. Go to vpr.net to check them out. Yesterday, we looked at the national controversy around Planned Parenthood and the implications for Planned Parenthood of Northern New England. Last week, a governing panel in New Hampshire voted to end $319,000 in annual state funding, giving more urgency to the issue in our region. Joining me now to read some of your comments about that discussion is our managing producer, Patty Daniels. Hi, Patty.
Hi, Jane. So the national controversy is about the practice of donating fetal tissue from abortions to medical research, and the allegation is that Planned Parenthood is profiting from that practice, which is illegal. And on that topic, we heard from Sue in Linden, who asks, I wonder how much of the discussion over fetal research today sounds like the discussion over cadaver research in the distant past.
But the allegations over managing fetal tissue have become a proxy for debating access to abortion generally, and many of you had comments on that topic. Aaron says, it saddens me once again that we are back here. Planned Parenthood is nothing but a victim of a politically motivated bullying. I am hopeful that we will rise above, and Planned Parenthood of Northern New England will continue to provide health care to women and teens. Health care is the key word here, Aaron says.
And Carrie writes to make the point that contraception doesn't always work, and she disagrees with how Planned Parenthood communicates that truth to women. She says, it seems to me that unborn children should not become victims because women rely on the falsehood aggressively promoted by Planned Parenthood that contraception will reliably prevent pregnancy. The Planned Parenthood rep in this interview made it sound as if women who become pregnant are surprised that sexual intercourse could result in pregnancy. And she treats such children as nothing more than a nuisance, interrupting the educational and career plans of women.
And Carrie goes on to say, let's stop using euphemisms and false information. Women at least need to understand that if they engage in sexual intercourse, they may become pregnant. Further, if their backup plan is abortion, they should at least be informed of what abortion is and does.
But we also heard from Melinda in Huntington, who writes, by cutting funding to Planned Parenthood of Northern New England in New Hampshire, you are in fact cutting funding that would prevent unintended pregnancies, therefore increasing abortions, cutting testing for AIDS and sexually transmitted infections, and cutting screening for breast cancer and cervical cancer.
And Alpha 16 says, remove all government funds from Planned Parenthood and redistribute them to area hospitals to provide the same women's care minus the abortions.
And finally, Megan in Burlington wrote us about her own story. She says, when I was a poor college student in the 1990s, Planned Parenthood helped me make responsible choices by providing low-cost contraception. And when I faced long-term unemployment during the Great Recession of 2008, I gratefully turned to Planned Parenthood for my annual checkups. And when I first moved to Vermont, I hadn't yet obtained health insurance, and I was able to get an STD test when I needed one, thanks to Planned Parenthood. And Megan says, finding myself financially strapped multiple times in my life has been challenging, but not nearly as difficult as things could have been had I not had access to the reproductive services that this important organization offers.
Well, we are really glad to give our listeners a platform to discuss difficult and controversial issues, and we are always grateful and impressed with how you all elevate the dialogue. Keep those comments coming. You can post to our Facebook page, or you can email us on any topic, write to vermontedition@vpr.net.
Okay. And before we go today, Jane, we are excited to share with listeners that it is actually our birthday on Vermont Edition.
Hooray!
The show started as a daily program 8 years ago, and we have been continually humbled and grateful to you, our listeners, ever since. So thank you very much for that. And this also seems like a great time to mention that if you are or you know a fabulous Vermont College student who would like to be our next intern, we're accepting applications now for our fall semester paid internship at our Colchester studio. You can go to vpr.net and look at our careers page to find all the details on how to apply. I want to point out that we have had a few interns in the past who have been such superstars that we hired them on as production assistants, and we are always grateful to help discover the next future public media journalists in our region. So please apply. Go to the careers page at vpr.net.
Thanks, Patty.
You're welcome.
All right, here are the people who make Vermont Edition shine. Our producers are Patty Daniels, Rick Singeri, and Sam Gail Rosen. Our production assistant, Erin Lucy, is one of those people Patty Daniels was just talking about. She got her start as one of our interns, and she is fabulous. Liam Connors and Mary Williams direct the program, and our executive producer is John Van Hoosen. I want to let you know about Friday's show. Boy, what a week for Bernie Sanders' presidential campaign. A poll shows him leading Hillary Clinton in New Hampshire, and he drew West Coast crowds topping 70,000 supporters. But also, a rally disrupted by protesters underscored a question more people are asking. Where is Bernie Sanders on racial inequality? So tomorrow on Vermont Edition, two experts look at the Sanders campaign and the Democratic presidential primary. You can send a note on that to Vermont Edition at vpr.net. I'm Jane Lindholm. Thanks for listening.